This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
So welcome to the latest in the series of podcasts produced by the Winchester Centre for Religion, Reconciliation and Peace. I'm delighted to have with me today my colleague, Dr. Andrew Gomez Suarez, who has joined the centre recently, but has a fascinating backstory, which we're going to be exploring in this podcast. So, Andre, thank you very much for agreeing to do this. Also, you're going to talk quite personally, so thank you for agreeing to do that. So, and I hope the experience is not too unhelpful for you. So we're going to be talking about your experiences initially as a child in Colombia. And I think what it might be helpful to start with is if you could just tell us a little bit about what the Patriotic Union was and perhaps a little bit about the role your parents played in that. I mean, would that be a good point to start, do you think?
Yes, sure, Simon. Thank you so much for suggesting doing this podcast, and I'm delighted to be here and to have joined the center. So this is a good way to start also my new role at the center at the University of Winchester. So let me just give a clear answer to your question. The Patriotic Union was a political party created in Colombia in 1985. In the context of a peace negotiation between the Colombian government and the FARC. It was the first time that a Colombian government tried to end the conflict through negotiations. And it was agreed that the FARC were gonna create a party that was gonna exist for about a year while they started doing the political work, and that slowly the FARC would demobilize, disarm, and move into full civilian life. In the context of creating the party, the FARC had a long connection with the Communist Party since the 1960s. There were at some moments the participation of some members of the FARC or some members of the Communist Party in the different boards of direction of both organizations. But they somehow, during the late 1970s, had started taking some distance, and the FARC had become like a more an army. In 1982, they took the decision to become People's Army, and they added those two words to their name. So they became the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, People's Army. And that turned them into a military machine, and the Communist Party somehow stayed aside. My dad had been one of the founders of the Communist Party in the city in which I grew up, that is called Pasto, in the south of Colombia, near to Ecuador. And he had been working and setting up the party with my mom since the late 1970s. And in 1984, when the Colombian government and the FARC agreed to create the UP, the FARC looked for support of the Communist Party. And the Communist Party, that had this long tradition of doing politics, somehow became like the center of the political platform that was going to include many different sectors of Colombian society into this party that was going to be the symbol of reconciliation in Colombia and be able to stop the war. And because my dad and my mom were members of the Communist Party, they were in charge of setting up the first cells of the UP in Pasto, in the city where I was. And so they were the founding members of the UP in Pasto in 1985.
Right. So, and at this stage, 1983, I think you were about 5 years old. Is that right?
Yes.
So you, this was happening whilst you were just beginning to become aware of the outside world. Obviously, we all know that the the proposal that the UP would become the kind of political wing of the revolutionaries and would engage in the peace process and hopefully would create some peace settlement. That's not what happened, was it?
Yeah, no, unfortunately, what happened was that as soon as the party was launched, as an assassination campaign against some of the members of the party started, the political party started doing politics and got some members in Congress, some of these Congress members started to get killed. They were killed by the military and by a perverse alliance of paramilitary groups and politicians in the regions. And in 1987, the president of the political party was killed near Bogota. And after 1987, the paramilitary groups and the army somehow started carrying out massacres against entire towns of the country where people had voted to have mayors of the UP party. So by 1990, about 1,500 members of the UP party had been killed. And then the presidential candidate of the second presidential candidate of the UP was killed in 1990. And a new wave of massacres started to take place in some of the strongholds where the party remained. By 2002, it was estimated that more than 5,000 members of one single political party had been killed in Colombia, that many of them had been internally displaced, some of them had gone into exile, and there were thousands of disappeared. So the party was destroyed, and the party went to the Inter-American Court claiming that they had been victims of political genocide. And so the hopes for peace were brought to an end, because one of the reasons why the FARC started to escalate the military campaign against the Colombian state in the 1990s was arguing that they had tried to do politics and that the party had been destroyed by the government and criminal groups.
And you're obviously a leading expert on this because you did a PhD in it and you continue to research it. But I'm particularly interested in to go back to the impact this had on your family.
Yeah, so when I was five, just before the UP party was created, in the Colombian army had been indoctrinated in anti-communist logic, as most of the countries who, most of the armies in the Western Hemisphere were, because the US had this very strong anti-communist approach. And they saw insurgencies, leftist insurgencies, as a threat to US hegemony in Latin America. And so the army in Colombia were constantly carrying out human rights violations against members of the Communist Party. So in the case of my dad, who was one of the leading members of the party in Pasto, sometimes in the evenings, the army would just break into our house and start looking for arms and start blaming my dad and saying that my dad was a terrorist member of the FARC and my dad was only a member of the Communist Party. So that in 1983 had a terrible impact on my mom and on my sister. They would come, they would break doors, they would take books out of the library we had. They would see books in Russian, because my dad studied in the Soviet Union, and they would take the books that were about chemistry, because my dad was a chemistry professor, and they would say, oh, this is a proof that he is part of the communist, international communist strategy that is trying to destroy Colombia's democracy. And then after spending, getting at home at, say, 1, 2 in the morning and waking everyone up and, throwing my dad around. They would take him away and they would keep him in prison without any legal argument for a couple of days, and then release him because they didn't have to keep it. And then when once the communist, once the UP was launched, my dad and my mom carried on doing political rallies. And in some of the cases, sometimes my dad wouldn't get home, and my mom would be very, very worried because he didn't get home. And then the next morning she would get up and try to look for him, and then going to, you know, first to the hospitals, then going to the battalions. And then at some point, thanks to the political pressure that was built up, she could find out that he had been put into a dark cell in one of the battalions, and then he had to be released because this was told to the public. So that's like a very clear direct impact. And then some of the leaders of the party, in particular the national leaders, would travel and do rallies in the country, and they would rely on the members of the party in order to stay overnight. And both presidents of the UP who were killed, both of them would visited us a week before they were killed, and they stayed in our house. My sister and I would play with them, and both of them, before they left the house, you know, they would organize some like political meetings and also some social gatherings with members of the party. And I remember very clearly the first president of the UP, Jaime Pardo Leal. I was 10 years old. I'm sitting in his legs and playing with him a bit towards the end of the evening. And then when most of the people have left and only he and my parents were around and probably a couple of friends, he would say, probably this is the last time I'm going to see you. I know that the people who are looking after me are the people who are going to kill me. I cannot trust anyone, and there is no way I'm going to come out of this alive. And I think those words resonated throughout my childhood all the time, because precisely 10 days later, he was killed in Bogota, near Bogota, traveling between his country house and Bogota. Yeah. And something quite similar happened to Bernardo Jaramillo, the second president of the UP. And this created a sense of, and both, I would say, in particular in my sister, my mom, and me, of never being able to be safe, that there were constant threats. So my mom would not sleep if we were not all of us at home. My mom didn't like us to meet new people, to talk about any of the things that were discussed. And so my mom felt that threats were coming from everywhere and that they could be the next people to be killed. And finally, the final thing that I just want to say is that in 1990, after they killed the second president of the UP, my mom decided to drop out of the political party, and my dad stayed. And in those moments, around those days, I remember my parents saying something that was very shocking to me. It was like, they have killed our national leaders. Now they can kill us all. We don't mind anymore. So we're ready for this, and come and get us. And as a 10 or 12 years old, listening to your parents saying this had an impact that I didn't recognize at the time.
Gosh, those are extraordinary, powerful experiences. You yourself were never the victim of violence directly, but you grew up in this culture of fear, and you witnessed people disappear. People who you got to know quite well.
And I would say that now thinking about this, I feel that I wasn't, because I was a child, but my dad was. My dad was tortured by the Colombian army. And I feel that also my mom was also, because she couldn't, she felt that when she was traveling from one place to the other in a city where there was not lots of violence, she was being, you know, followed by different people. So we wouldn't stay in friends' houses until very late at night, or we wouldn't go to visit our family to the countryside. Whenever we were traveling across the country and we would go to some regions, my mom would not like to go into some towns where there was presence of paramilitary groups, because she felt that we could be victims of this. And there were lists of leaders of the UP that were circulating around, of people who were going to be killed. And they say that in some cases, some of their names were in those lists. But, you know, there were some in some occasions also in the headquarters of the UP party, you would get all these death threats thrown into the headquarters, and the headquarters also were bombed. There was like an attack on the headquarters, and I was quite lucky that my parents were there. So I think, you know, it was very close to, it was against my family. So even though so many people feel that they were victims of that violence in a firsthand experience, the way how I reflected on this at the time is that I wasn't victim, because my parents were not killed, but there were different forms of victimization. And that's something that is sometimes very difficult to understand. And when I think about my dad being tortured and all the psychological pressure that my mom suffered, I would say, well, we were victims of this.
These are very, very powerful memories that you have. And I know, I mean, you know, we both teach reconciliation, so the subject of memory is one of great interest to us. And how memories are retrieved, what the status of recollections is, how they perhaps change over time, the different types of memories we have. These are all very significant issues when it comes to recovering the past, isn't it? So, and I know this is something that you have thought deeply about, and that you're working on a memoir of your childhood experiences, which I think is absolutely fascinating. And could you tell us a bit about how you are approaching that? Because there are obviously a lot of issues here about what these memories actually represent, isn't there? And what is your relationship as an adult to these childhood memories? So talk us through how you're approaching this memoir.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good question, Simon. And I, if you allow me, I'm going to try to do a loop here to try to see if I can get there. You're right. Memory is an absolutely fundamental element of reconciliation processes. But memories are very, very painful. And sometimes we unconsciously put them on the back of our mind as a survival strategy. So I have to say that I started writing this memoir in 2018. And that means that it took me 30 years after witnessing the killings of these people and these experiences and the violence against my family to start getting into the memories in a personal fashion. Before doing that, I had to work through what I have lived with the lens of objectivity. And I really probably didn't know that I was dealing with trauma. So my first way into this was to try to find the truth in the sense of an academic. So in 2005, that is, say 20 years after I witnessed what I witnessed as a child, I decided to start a master's course on genocide and war politics. And suddenly, after 10 years of silence in my house, of never speaking about the impact that this had, I opened a Pandora box that was what happened to the political party in which my parents were members a case of genocide. And it was really a question that I wanted to answer, not as an individual who felt that there was something associated with that, but as an academic, I needed to find evidence to see if the right way to describe it was genocide. So I explored the case, the destruction of the political party. I did archival research. I went to the US, the Library of the Congress in the US. I went to the archives in Colombia. I got access to privileged archives of people who were members of the UP party who had never opened their archives in order to be able to see all those things that were happening. I interviewed people. I did focus groups, you know, and I read all the books that had been written by survivors and few academics who had looked into this. And that resulted in my first book that is called Genocide, Geopolitics and Transnational Networks. That was the book, the product of my PhD, in which I use an objective lens to try to describe what had happened. And now that research is being used somehow to back up the case against the Colombian state for genocide in the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. But even though when I started working as an academic, I could see my memories, I tried to push them aside. So I dealt with them quickly. I, of course, confronted them because otherwise I wouldn't have been able to move into the academic side of things. But I sort of cried, remember things, and put them in a box and left them aside. And in 2018, suddenly the idea of being able to dig into this again, but leaving academia aside and now focusing on the memories and try to convey those memories to a different audience and to say, this did happen. I mean, this is what I remember of what happened. And I was working at the time in a project at the University of Bristol on memories from the margins, that was trying to see how in reconciliation processes, we need to work in the production of historical memory on the based on the work that the very communities make, you know, based on, so it's not like the communities themselves do memory exercises. And by doing memory exercises, they find a way to move into reconciliation. So it's not that we experts, academics, go into these communities and teach them how to do memory and how to do reconciliation, but they already, in a very intuitive way, do it. So this started to make me think that a way I had something there that I needed to tell, that I needed to explore, that my memory was something that I had never given voice and that it needed to come out in order to understand how somehow I had managed to cope with the trauma of the violence of my family. And I was very lucky because at the time, because I married Gwen Barnett and her mom is Ruth Padel, and Ruth has written 25, 30 books, some in poetry, some in fiction, and two novels. And we started exploring the idea of how, instead of using an academic voice, I could use the voice of the child. And so this meant a really incredible exercise of unfolding a new Pandora box that was, let's don't privilege the voice of the child that is only focusing on what happened to the party, but what happened to the child in those 10 years? What is the memory of the child with the family? What is the memory? How is the identity of the child come into being? What is the place of love into this whole story? So somehow, and somehow after the first pages that I started typing that were very academic, because that's what we learned to do, after a couple of months, I started finding a voice that allowed me to navigate and tell the story, not of that child, but the story of the family of that child and of the country in which that family existed and associated with the memories that that child had of his interactions with a multiplicity of actors that were in the middle of this very complex, terrible war that Colombia has experienced in the last 50 years.
Andrea, this is most interesting. Inevitably, someone comes to mind for me, which is Michael Lapsley, who runs the Institute for the Healing of Memories in South Africa. In fact, I did a podcast with him in this series, which I must let you listen to. And he would be absolutely fascinated to hear what you're doing, because it's what he has been doing with survivors of trauma in South Africa and many other places as well, through processes of storytelling and recovery of memories, trying to produce some way of moving on from the pain of those memories. But what's particularly interesting, I think, of what you said there is you're telling the story both from the point of view of the child, but also the family and the society. So there are kind of multiple voices in this story you're telling. Is that right?
Yes, I think what I have managed to do, and I'm like sort of getting into my third draft, this was something that I thought it was going to be 10,000 words, and is now 90,000. It's a book. It's a book length. And it's so what I have done is to so far is to let the child speak on a first voice, on the I, and sometimes, and this is very good for our teaching also, Simon, sometimes, and in particular moments, the child has dialogues. The child talks to other to other people who are in that moment. So the child talks, I talk to my dad, and my dad responds to me as my dad. So there is a dimension of fiction there, because I didn't have a diary. So I cannot remember the exact words that my dad told me at the time, but what I can remember is the sense of the words, how the words convey a particular thought process of a time. And in that way, what I have done is, so the child talks to my dad, to my sister, I talk to my mom, but I have started to also see the broader picture, in which I had to talk to my uncles on my dad's side and on my mom's side. And the two families are very very different families, because one family, my mom's family, was living in Bogota, the capital town of Colombia, the capital city, okay? And the other family was living in Pasto, that is in the south, very near to Ecuador. And so Colombia is a country that is split into different regions, and the violence have divided Colombia's society and Colombian regions. So the memoir allows me also to be able to show these regional differences through the experience of the child that goes and visits one side of the family and the other side of the family. And this allows me to show a far more complex picture than the one I told you at the beginning, in which I suffered violence because my parents were members of the UP party, but to see that my family, different sectors of my mom's family and my dad's family, suffered violence by different actors. So I start telling the story of how one of my uncles on my dad's side was almost killed by the FARC in one of the ambushes that they did in one town. And on the other side, on my mom's side, I can show how the FARC tried to kidnap one of my uncles, and he had to pay extortion rates to try to not be kidnapped. So this is what the memoir allows me to do, is, and I put voices into them that, again, they are not exactly what they said at the time, because I cannot remember the exact words. But what I know is what happened and the importance that that has for Colombian society to be heard now. And finally, what I would say is that this is, of course, is a very difficult thing that I have to do, and something that I haven't I haven't done yet, is that this could be very intrusive for those sectors of my family. You know, my dad is probably happy with it, because I have discussed with him this project, and with my sister we are happy, and we have brainstormed a bit, and I have been trying to bring memories from what they remember. So I'm including my family into writing this together. But I haven't mentioned this to my uncles and to my cousins farther away. And I know that they won't feel comfortable with it. So the decision that I'm having to take is to anonymize it, because it's not fair to put it out there like that. And so what I'm still in the process of deciding what is going to happen with the child and the family in terms of keeping at least my name and the names of the closer family, or whether the whole thing should be anonymized with some acknowledgements that say that this is based on, you know, I'm still in sort of that decision making, which shows, and with this I finish, the important role that fiction writing could have in processes of reconciliation. And, you know, I have heard this so many times. When you think about Death and the Maiden, this fantastic, you know, play by Ariel Dorfman, talking about the Argentina junta in the 1980s, and how he used fiction to try to talk about this. Well, that's what is happening now to me. I am somehow trying to keep my academic hat, but take it away in one particular moment to try to do an experiment of how doing fiction writing can help us think through the challenges for reconciliation processes and to healing, and, you know, having a new vision of a different future.
This is absolutely fascinating, Andre, and it ties in with some of the things that you and I have been teaching. For instance, the idea from Mikhail Bakhtin about polyphony, multiple voices in literature. And of course, that's something you would also find in the works of Marquez. And I'm wondering to what extent your familiarity with the great tradition of Colombian literature and South American literature more broadly is an influence for you here.
Huh. Wow. I have to say that this is a question that I have to try to organize my thought process around it. But if I could just give some ideas, the first one is, I have to say, and you probably are going to be shocked about this, that I haven't been a big fan of Marquez. I haven't actually read Marquez a lot. There is one of A Chronicle for There Foretold is perhaps my favorite book of Marquez. But even though I have started 25 times, 100 Years of Solitude, I have never finished it. And I find it fantastic. And I now I find it fantastic, and I have tried to finish it. But
I think there are a large number of people in that particular club, by the way.
But that said, in my university years, I discovered mainly the writing of Ernesto Sabato, the Argentinian writer. And I think I like fiction but mainly coming from Sabato and other writers. But something that probably is connected with this, and I hadn't thought about this until you asked me the question, is that when I went back to Colombia after doing my PhD in England and started working in the Colombian peace process as a practitioner, I also joined the University of Los Andes as a lecturer. And I put together a course on the Colombian conflict. But the decision I took in that particular moment, that was last semester of 2015, and first semester of 2016, so in the middle of the negotiations, precisely when the negotiations between the FARC and the government were about to come to a final peace agreement, and that was going to be put forward for a referendum, what I decided was that I wanted to teach that course through novels. So I went and I read all the novels that had been written in Colombia in the last 20 years that were talking only about the armed conflict. And so I put together this course with 15 novels that the students had to read, one per week. And then I discovered a fantastic writer that many of his novels have been translated into English, and I really recommend him, is Juan Gabriel Vázquez. And Vázquez wrote a book called The Sound of Things Falling. a beautiful novel, and The Shape of the Ruins. That is his second novel that is fantastic. And I was really deep into these readings, you know, and it's been one of the best courses I have ever thought. Students were so emotional. Students had to start making connections between these that was getting to the core of their emotions and the academic reading that they were doing that seemed so positivist and detached and objective and rational. And I guess because of that, I started thinking more and more and more about the need to do research on emotions. How peace building cannot happen without an incredible emotional transformation of a society. And so I ended up writing my second book, again, still academic, as with academic lens, on the role of emotions in the peace referendum in Colombia, which was lost. So people voted against the peace referendum. And now what I have done is to take that even further and is to say, no, I don't want to reflect on the role of emotions. I want to be the emotions that I'm writing in this memoir. And the only way you can do that is through fiction writing.
Yeah, this is absolutely fascinating, Andre. And we could have a much longer conversation about this. I just, in passing, one thing I just liked, in case any of our students are listening to this, when you talked about recreating the voices of your father and your sister and your uncle and so forth, that for me connects with this idea of imaginal dialogues that we've talked about from the work of Hubert Hermans and multiple I positions. So I think it would be very interesting to see what you actually produce here. Will this book be in Spanish or in English?
No, the book is in English. And I think that's a really good question. I don't think I would have been able to write this book in Spanish, because there is also something related with being English my second language that allows me to be able to write in an English that is basic, that is the voice of a 10 years old is a very basic voice, and the thought process. So the memoir has a very particular rhythm, and also the sentences are much more cleaner, less complicated and convoluted thought processes, but actually clean and clear of a child that's got some sort of impressions of what's happening in life. So hopefully, and this is one of the things that I hope I'll be able to do as part of the work at the center, is that I would start looking for publishers and things like that towards the end of this year. So the book would be at some point ready for publication, probably towards the end of next year or something like that, in English.
This is a tremendous project, and I'm sure the university will want you to publish it. Interesting that English gives you not only a degree of detachment, but it also gives you perhaps a more neutral voice for the child, which is interesting given what you said about emotions. You're wanting to express emotions, but you're choosing perhaps, an Anglo-Saxon language, which is perhaps less emotional than Spanish. But anyway, let's not go there. Okay, there's one really tough question I think I know you well enough to ask you now, just to conclude this interview, which is, I'm sure whilst you've been doing this extraordinary work of recovering your memories, reflecting, trying to recreate history, understand, through the child's eyes, what you observed in the world around you, you must have thought about the people who perpetrated this violence on the party, your family, and so forth. Have you ever, we teach reconciliation. We talk about encounters between previous enemies. Is that something that you have thought about, considered, the conversations you might have with the people who murdered the president, for instance?
Well, I think, one of the things that I've done as a practitioner is being to work on peace building. So When I finished my PhD in 2012 and then in 2014, I went back to Colombia to work on the peace process. And one of the things that I did was to join the National Center for Historical Memory. That was a Colombian institution working on some reports to bring to the center of the public debate in Colombia the memory of the victims of the conflict. As an advisor to the director, I was a part of a project with the military. So I had to sit with the generals and members of the military to think about how we could work with their own memories of the conflict. So I've been face to face with members of the armed forces who deny the campaign to destroy the party by the army. And I have worked with them. And they know the book that I have written, and I know and I know the things that some of them have done. But we have been able to understand that the future of the country is something that needs to be put at the center of our interaction. And it is not easy. It is challenging because we push each other, you know, in different ways, but there is a recognition of the humanity of the other and the need to stop the continuation of violence. The same with paramilitary groups. When I did my research on the UP, I interviewed paramilitary leaders to try to understand what was the rationale behind doing the killings that they did. And I went to some of the audiences of some of the politicians who participated in the genocide, or in the what I call the genocidal geopolitical conjuncture of the UP. So in a way, I've been doing that. I've been engaging in that. It is the main challenge that we have today. And this was a different context 4 years ago than now, because 4 years ago, even the president of Colombia took the decision, the political decision of apologizing. So he did a public apology to the party saying the Colombian state is responsible for not protecting the lives of the members of the political party. And I think that was a tremendous healing exercise for the members, for my family, and even for me. The problem that we have now, and that created a positive environment to think about reconciliation, because you could see that parties were taking responsibility for their actions. But now we have a government that denies the involvement of the part of the state in these killings, who is trying to minimize the role that they played. And this makes far more complicated the dialogues with them. And who knows how it would be today to sit down with some of the militaries in Colombia who, if they are going to sit with a very narrow, close-minded approach in which they deny responsibility. I can just see, and this is what happened to many victims of the UP now, is that they are seeing that in Colombia there is not a space for accountability and for the rewriting of a common narrative of the things that should never happen. And for that reason, they are looking for the Inter-American Court of Human Rights to actually condemn the Colombian state for genocide, because it's the only way they can see justice being done in Colombia. And so that divides people. But I don't think, and this with this I would close for our sort of thinking on reconciliation. And it's I don't think that polarization and reconciliation are in the opposite spectrum. Actually, they are the same, the two different sides of a similar coin. They are intertwined. Sometimes it is necessary, you know, after denial, that is also normal. Denial is normal. It's not easy to acknowledge the wrongdoings of the past. But after that, there is a moment of anger. There is a moment of polarization. There is a moment, and sometimes once the polarization gets to the extreme, there can be a resolution, but a resolution in which finally acknowledgement happens and both sectors can move together to try to find the way to coexist respectfully.
Andre, I think what really strikes me about this conversation is you live And you continue, you have lived and you continue to live many of the issues that we teach on this course in reconciliation. And I think our students have so much to gain from your arrival there. I think we have to stop this conversation now because we will be trying the patience of our listeners, I think, if we go on too long. But I think we'd very much like to have another conversation with you to pick up some of these other strands here, because there is so much in what you say that illustrates some of the important theoretical concepts we have about reconciliation and brings life to them. So thank you very much indeed. I hope talking about this has not been too uncomfortable for you.
Simon, it's been an absolute pleasure and fantastic. And I really look forward to having a second podcast with you because you are such a great interviewer and it's been really, really enjoyable. So thank you so much for suggesting it.
Thank you.